This is audio book of The Cosmic Doctrine, Dion Fortune. Millennium Preface. The Cosmic Doctrine is a condensed blueprint outline of God's manifestation in this creation. Complex indeed. But what has tended to bother some about the Cosmic Doctrine teaching has been the almost total emphasis in explaining evolution simply as being the psychic nuts and bolts of God, leaving one with the impression that God may be reduced from a great and infinite being to a kind of mechanical Newtonian clockwork. However, there is much more to it than that. The higher up the planes you go, although esoteric theory tends to describe it as all more abstract, in actual fact things become so much more complex, vibrant, vivid, bursting, and brimming with life in incredible profusion. It is another form of experience, however. The broadest, though simple, analogy would be to liken the existence on the higher levels as something after the order of a bark fugue, which could indeed seem to some a rather dry abstraction, but which to the attuned and educated ear is a revelation of divinity, harmony and celestial order. The reality is not easy to describe in concepts, let alone in words. How best to describe a rainbow to a blind man? Contents Section 1. Chapter 1. The First Manifestation. Knowledge falls into two divisions: the record of facts and the explanation thereof. Knowledge can only consist of that which is present in the mind. That which does not enter the mind cannot be known. Therefore you can only know that which you have senses to interpret to you. As new senses open up, more planes of existence can be known. There is, however, a limit to the knowledge of the finite. Perception ceases at the barrier of manifestation. Of that which lies beyond we can only know by analogy. The unmanifest is pure existence. We cannot say of it that it is not. Although it is not manifest, it is. It is the source from which all arises. It is the only reality. It alone is substance. It alone is stable. All else is an appearance and a becoming. Of this unmanifest we can only say it is. It is the verb to be turned back upon itself. It is a state of pure being without qualities and without history. All we can say of it is that it is not anything that we know, for if we know anything it must be in manifestation for us to know it, and if it is in manifestation it is not unmanifest. Therefore the very fact that we can know it proves that it is not unmanifest. The unmanifest is the great negation, at the same time it is the infinite potentiality which has not occurred. It is best conceived of under the image of interstellar space. In the occult teachings you have been given certain images, under which you are instructed to think of certain things. These images are not descriptive but symbolic, and are designed to train the mind, not inform it. Therefore you may think of the unmanifest as interstellar space, and of the Logos as a sun surrounded by his solar system of planets and of the emanations of the Logos as rays. The unmanifest is the only unity. Manifestation begins when duality occurs. The prime duality is space and movement. The first manifestation was a current in space. The metaphor I must use may convey nothing to your mind. All I can say is that space was moving. You will find these clues are a clue to much. Now when space moves it has this peculiar quality: being frictionless it never loses momentum but continues to flow. When space moves two forces are at work: the force which causes it to move, being the desire of space for momentum; b, the force which had hitherto caused it not to move, being the desire of space for inertia. These two factors are present in all motion, but the desire for movement, being the stronger, overcomes the desire for inertia, and the desire for inertia continues as a check upon the movement. Therefore the movement is pulled upon slightly. That is why there is no such thing as a straight line in the cosmos. All movement therefore has a slight curve in its projection, therefore eventually it returns to the spot whence it started, and forms a spinning ring. Now the prime movement is just a flowing of space that returns after long eons whence it started, and then renews its journey. This sets up a spinning belt of enormous circumference. This belt spins on one plane for immense eons of time, spins with a changeless spinning. but its tendency is to communicate its motion to the space about it, which leads more space to flow into the spinning. All this, remember, is metaphor. The spinning in one plane continues until the stresses which it generates evoke a new movement, and a second current in space is set up at right angles to the first, and the same process is repeated. These spinning planes of force may be conceived of as resembling the rings of Saturn. We have now two spinning planes which, at two points, cut each other, and it is worthy of note that the second plane forms outside the first and is therefore larger in diameter. For countless eons these planes spin at right angles to each other, and the whole of evolution turns upon the difference in size between the planes. When the larger has got up to the same speed as the smaller and older, it commences to attract one aspect of it, the consequence being that the older circle is drawn towards the newer. Now the first circle must be conceived of as having an upper and a lower surface. The upper surface of the outflowing arc may be conceived of as positive and the lower as negative, the reverse being the case in the inflowing arc. Likewise with the second circle to arise. These circles are mutually attracting and repelling each other, so that you conceive the upper surface of the outflowing arc of the first circle, being positive, rising up towards its corresponding aspect in the second circle, and the lower circle in the returning arc pressing downwards, so that you get a second movement imparted to the spinning disc. When this secondary movement has completed its first circuit and set up its steady revolution, the new cosmos is in being. That is the prime beginning of a cosmos expressed in the nearest approximate metaphor. The secondary spin of the first circuit is the ring pass knot, and the circuit of the second formation is that sphere which sets abound to chaos. On the outer sphere there is a secondary derivation, and though a spinning circle of motion, represents for that cosmos, the prime stillness, the immobility in which it is rooted, it is the thrust block of the force of the cosmos, that which resists, which alone enables momentum to be achieved, and you may call it the ring chaos, the prime evil. It is evolved from the reaction of the prime force in order to take its thrust. It spins at right angles to the prime spin. It counteracts it. It was the attraction of the ring chaos inducing a secondary spin in the ring cosmos which forms the ring pass knot. Now that movement in the ring cosmos, spinning in one plane and rotating while it spins as if upon an axis, sets the bounds beyond which the creatures of that universe cannot pass, even in thought. But this universe is a sphere encircled by two lines of force, the ring cosmos and the ring chaos, rotating at right angles to each other. The momentum of the ring cosmos is the source of force from which evolution draws its momentum, and the rotation of the ring chaos is the source of force from which dissolution draws its power. Evolution is a thrust from the surface towards the center. Devolution, or dissolution, is a suction into outer space. The ring chaos does not belong to the universe it encircles, but to outer space. That is an important point in connection with it. The ring cosmos has its desires turned towards the sphere it encircles. The ring chaos has its desires turned towards the space that encircles it. The ring cosmos seeks to extend the center. The ring chaos seeks to expand the circumference. The ring cosmos tends to solidify by contraction. The ring chaos to return to the unmanifest, whence it arose, and therefore, if its influence were unchecked, to reduce the universe it encircles to nothingness. The ring cosmos, if its influence were unchecked, would be static in the immediate present. These two influences are the source of all the force in the cosmos, the ring cosmos because it concretes, builds up, the ring chaos because it diffuses, never grows. Now these two rings we will call good and evil, life and death, light and darkness, spirit and matter, being and not being, God and devil, because each of these potencies has its root in its respective ring. But let it be clearly conceived that the ring good and the ring evil are not good and evil as you understand them, but merely spinning circles of force at right angles to each other, and therefore in opposition, and it is merely the angle of the first to arise which is called good, and the angle in opposition to the prime plane is called evil, and it might well be that in another cosmos the first plane would begin to spin at another angle, the angle of your evil, it would still be good to its cosmos, because good and evil do not depend upon any plane or angle, but are simply relative to each other. The first force to arise is called good because, from it arises the line of force called evolution. All subsequent secondary forces are measured by that standard. Insofar as they move in the same angle, they are reckoned to be good. Insofar as they approach to a right angle, they are reckoned to be in opposition and are called evil. Evil is simply that which is moving in the opposite direction to evolution. Evil is that which approaches the plane of movement of the ring chaos and therefore tends to revert to the unmanifest. All evil that builds up with the universe is attracted towards the ring chaos and is self-destroyed, because the very name evil means a force which tends to non-existence. So you can conceive of evil under two aspects: : that which enables you to lock up the forces of good by opposition, and so secure stability, a foothold. Evil enables you to get a purchase on space. B. Evil, if allowed to function unopposed, is the scavenger of the gods. Therefore said the Great One, our Master, resist not evil. When you resist evil, you lock up good. You lock up the force of good which holds the evil inert. This serves no useful purpose, unless you have a superabundance of good which shall stand upon the platform thus formed and leap up from it to greater heights. Therefore it is not enough to meet hate with love, evil with good. This is the course of the ignorant and the reason why exoteric religion has made so little impression in the world. You must hate with hate sufficiently to cause a locking up of the force. You must hate the hate and, having rendered evil inert by opposition, the love can take its stand upon the firm platform and use it as a thrust block. Therefore you only oppose evil when you wish to do constructive work, when you wish to make something new. You never oppose the evil when you wish to destroy. You make a vacuum round it. You prevent opposition from touching it. Then, being unopposed, it is free to follow the law of its own nature, which is, to join the motion of the ring chaos. It, therefore, passes out to the periphery of the universe until it meets the spin of the ring pass, not which it cannot get through, but it has gone to a place of such primitive simplicity that it is resolved into its own elements, and these elements are drawn into the attraction of the nearest motion, which is the nature of the ring cosmos, which is the nature of good. Therefore evil, when unopposed, resolves itself into the undifferentiated raw material of existence, the first form of manifestation. It ceases to be organized. It ceases to have qualities. It starts afresh at the beginning, transmuted through neutrality into good. It is the spin of these two rings which give the influences that play upon creation. You are now in a position to know why the mystery of evil is the secret of the initiates. Because when you understand evil, it is exceedingly useful. But the undisciplined man, if he knew the usefulness and goodness of evil, would use it dynamically on the positive side of its manifestation, not statically by availing himself of its negative qualities as does the initiate. You see, it is a matter of geometry. That is why numbers are so important, and remember, numbers in occultism refer to the degrees of angles. The degrees of the numbers of white occultism are marked in the ring cosmos. The degrees of the numbers of evil are marked in the ring chaos. Always think of the number in referring to the degree of an angle of two intersecting lines of force, and remember that when you operate on more than one plane, you get the angles of the intersecting of the planes. You will have more instruction about that. Every plane has three rings, like the cosmos. Also you can get intersections between different types of movement like time and space. These things will be studied later. Chapter 2. The First Trinity. You have found, no doubt, that the teaching is abstruse and unfamiliar. Believe me, it is more difficult to give than to receive, for that which is described so greatly transcends the condition upon which language has been built up, that the very images have to be built in your consciousness before they can be evoked by any spoken word. You have to conceive of the cosmos, in its primal aspect, as consisting of three spinning movements. All that is nothing but movement, movement in space, pure movement. For the prime movement which gives rise to all that is, commences before there is anything to move. The cosmos then, is bounded by that movement which is called the ring pass knot. But besides the ring pass knot, there are movements in two directions. There are the ring cosmos and chaos, good and evil, and they are the sources of the forces which are known to you by these names. But though these forces influence that which is within the ring pass not, they cannot pass beyond it. These three rings are the three primaries of the cosmos, the first trinity. That is why the Supreme Being is always conceived of as a trinity, and three is the fundamental number. Everything in the end is reducible to these three influences. Whatever subsequent stresses arise may be analyzed into the balancing of these three forces: a, the force of the ring cosmos which tends towards the center; b, the force of the ring chaos which tends towards outer space; c, the force of the ring pass not which holds the balance between them and prevents either of these forces from going to extremes. The ring pass not, however, is derived from the ring cosmos and therefore partakes of its nature rather than of that of the ring chaos. The ring chaos must always be thought of as having its affinity with the outer space of the unmanifest, and a tendency to return to unmanifestation. It looks towards the past, and ever seeks the conditions of the past. The ring cosmos endeavors to focus, as the ring chaos endeavors to diffuse. The tendency of the ring cosmos is towards the future. The ring chaos can never build anything, because whatever forces it may originate diffuse, unconfined, into outer space, but the ring cosmos, in conjunction with the ring pass not, conserve its forces. For the forces which the ring cosmos radiated into that space within its circumference cannot pass out again because they are confined by the influences of the ring pass not. Therefore they act and interact among themselves, producing ever greater and greater elaboration of influences. Let us now return to the point in time when the ring pass not had completed its first revolution and the cosmos is in being. Any form of force, when it has reached the maximum momentum of its type of movement, gives rise to the secondary movements which serve to carry off the excess of force which it is generating. For force begets force when moving under frictionless conditions. The prime activity is movement. The secondary activity is light. The third activity is sound. The movement of the ring cosmos sets up secondary swirls within the area of its influence. Its tendency is to draw more and more space into its spin. It cannot extend itself externally because it is limited by the sphere of the ring pass not. It therefore extends itself internally, so that the spinning belt finally becomes a spinning disc with the center immobile. The spinning disc, being rotated by the secondary movement, which is the ring pass not, becomes the spinning sphere. The interaction of the two forms of movement is naturally neutralizing. Consequently, there is a breakup of the simple movement of the disc into a series of compromises. The chief point of activity ceases to be the circumference and becomes the center. Although the ring cosmos, the ring chaos and the ring pass not each continue on one plane, and spin in their own place, the synthesis of their movements give rise to a series of revolving radii. These radii are the rays. You must conceive of them as a series of spinning rings linking center to circumference and C:A, the influence of the ring chaos in the force which causes the outgoing current to flow towards the periphery; B, the influence of the ring cosmos in the force which causes the current to flow towards the center; C, the center is the synthesis of all the forces and the balancing of them. It will be perceived then that upon the cosmic plane the rays give rise to the central sun. We have now arrived at a point when, in addition to the three great primaries, which are strictly external to the cosmos they have generated, we have a purely cosmic movement, the movement of the flowing rays, the rays that flow out and return. Now these rays, these circular rays, which are reflected back from the ring pass not, must be thought of in pairs, each one being in special association with its opposite number, so that the true movement is a figure of 8, the outgoing flow being above in one half of the circle, and below in the opposite half. Herein is a very deep truth closely related to practical occultism. These new movements set up stresses among themselves which give rise to a series of concentric rings of movement, so that the cosmos becomes divided up into segments of influence. The movements of the spinning rays and the concentric circles are known as the great secondaries. There are 12 rays and 7 concentric circles. Within the segments are set up the movements which are known as tangentials. The nearest analogy to these is the Brownian movement of atoms. The intersecting of the rings and the rays giving rise to angles, and the sharp tangential movement thus occasioned introduces a new factor into the cosmos. You now perceive that we have studied three types of movement: A, the interaction of the primal rings; B, the interaction of the secondary rays and circles; C, the tangential movements occasioned by the opposition of the angles and the secondaries. In these tangential movements, the lines of force are continually crossing each other's paths, being confined to small segments of the cosmos. Where they cross, the vortex is set up by the opposing influences modifying each other's actions. There, instead of proceeding in these slight curves, which give rise to enormous circles, they are reflected into a new movement and gyrating about each other become relatively static, thus setting up a composite unit, two forces which no longer are influenced independently by the attractions of greater forces, but are influenced together. Thus are atoms formed. Two intersecting forces setting up a vortex and gyrating about each other, instead of circling the limits of the cosmos. I have described the formation of the prime atom. These atoms, acting as units, likewise perceive the attraction of the units about them and begin to move in their turn, and the same process occurs again. Atoms in movement meet and gyrate, and so the process is continued. The tendency of the composite atoms is to travel towards the periphery, and of the simple atoms to remain near the center. It is thus that the planes of cosmic matter are developed. So that, to recapitulate, we have 1. The primary movement of the rings. 2. The secondary movement of the rays. 3. The tertiary movement of the tangentials within the segments. 4. The quaternary movement of the vortices. 5. The quintecular movement of the composite atoms. You will meet these numbers again. 1 refers to the absolute. 2 to the manifest. 3 to evolution. 4 to form. 5 to life. Chapter 3. The building of the atom. You have had described to you the types of movement which make up the cosmos. The primary rings, the rays and the secondary circles. Now these are the basis of a cosmos, and their influences are the underlying influences of that cosmos. Their evolution, it is, which make the great cycles the days and nights of manifestation. A day being the time when an aspect of the cosmos is within what you would call the positive area of the magnetic field generated by the spinning rings, and the night when it is in the negative area. By a knowledge of these cosmic tides, the illuminated may avail himself of their forces, hence the power of a knowledge of the numbers of the secret calendar. These then are the primary influences. They may be thought of as the framework of the cosmos. The tangential forces, within the segments of their interaction, set up vortices, and these vortices are the primal atoms. You may perceive that in the building of an atom the same laws are at work as enabled the ring cosmos and the ring chaos to build the cosmos. It is the law of the opposing forces which produce stability. The opposing forces, having produced atoms, the atoms themselves become forces, because they move in their turn. And so different types of tangential reactions occurred, movements influenced by more than one attraction. So that, from the simple right-angled movement, produced by a single opposing force, vortices are described of a polyhedronal type. You can see the material form of such reaction in the different types of crystals to which they give rise upon your plane. So that you will get atoms, the tangential path of whose component forces can be anything from a three-sided figure upwards. You must realize clearly that the primal atom consists of two opposing movements which gyrate about each other. These are simply vortices, but the vortices can move through space as a water spout can move over the ocean, and these vortices can be induced to assume a secondary movement. It is these secondary movements which I refer to as being of an angular path. So you will get the different types of atom, which is merely a spinning to the spinning atom, which moves in a triangle, the type which makes a square, the type which describes a five-sided figure, and a six-sided figure, etc. These atoms attract each other, and can draw together and adhere to each other by means of what? Metaphorically speaking, I will call the facets of their orbits. Thereby they can form alliances among themselves. Thus different types of atoms arise in the cosmos and begin to gather themselves together into composite bodies. Each composite body, as it increases in size, increases also its power of attraction, so that the tendency of the cosmos is to aggregation, and the aggregates form adjustments amongst themselves so that new forces arise periodically. These we shall consider in their turn. You will perceive that we have now described, in addition to the great ring forces of the cosmos, the formation of an infinite number of minute centers of stability of varying types, and the continued organization of the reactions among these centers. You will perceive that great phases would be gone through in the course of this evolution, for each new force that arose had to radiate out through the entire cosmos until turned back in its course by the ring pass knot, and it would only be after it had returned from whence it arose, and so completed its circle, that it could become a constant influence with the cosmos. Within the limits of the rays and the circles, the newly built atoms would cannon and rebound for eons before any coordination would be induced among them. But as chance would govern the occurrence of two or more moving parallel to each other, where this occurred, their forces would reinforce each other and draw yet more into the orbit of their activity, so that the mere rebound would give place to the ordered recurrence of influences, and therefore to definite paths. There are already worked out in the cosmos the great lines of force which we call the rays, and the currents of the rays would gradually influence the great oceans of rebounding atoms to flow in their track, so that gradually the uncoordinated forces are coordinated into the great tides of the cosmos, and through meeting their own tangential action, move also with the great tides. I am now going to put before you a concept which may seem strange to you, but which is the basis of much in practical occultism. At the beginning of these teachings I said to you space moved. Whenever a movement has occurred in space, the flowing action thus set up remains. Space, when set in motion, never stops flowing because it is frictionless. A force has been generated which remains. This force may be blended with other forces, so that for all practical purposes it ceases to be a separate unit, yet it still retains its original character, and, could you analyze the unit of which it forms a part, you would find it there intact. Remember this point: space, set in motion, flows forever. Thus supposing, metaphorically speaking, you move your pen across the paper 1 inch, that movement would give rise to a current in space which would flow in its positive form in one aspect of the movement, and return in its negative form in its other aspect. That would remain, and whosoever could discern that movement in space, could discern the action which gave rise to it. This is the basis of memory, and this is the reason that it is easier to repeat a movement which has been performed before. And the more often it has been performed, the easier is the repetition, because the momentum of space is cumulative and will avail to carry the movement in its current. You will find this explains much. You have had spread before you a cosmos which arose out of space through movement, and which is movement and nothing else. You have seen how the stresses of forces generated by these movements have given rise to an infinite number of vortices, built upon exactly the same principle as the great vortex which is the cosmos, because the same laws hold good upon every scale of manifestation, being laws of relationship. You will then see that relationship occurs between the new centers of force thus built, and they tend to form new cosmoi among themselves, built upon the same principles. Dances of atoms give rise to new rings cosmos, and the story begins again. But these new universes, as they are called, while they have the same laws as the cosmos before described, are also influenced by that framework of the cosmos which was built before they began, and you will find that this law holds good throughout all manifestation. Chapter 4. The Evolution of the Atom. We will recapitulate the teaching in relation to the rays, the circles and the vortices. The rays and the circles are part of the primary movement of the cosmos. These, together with the rings, remain constant in the cosmos and are referred to as the cosmic currents. The vortices are of another nature. The primary movements are circular. The vortices start as straight movements which, encountering opposition, assume a secondary circular movement. There is therefore always a pair of forces concerned in the creation of the primal atom, and this fundamental duality extends into all combinations of which the atom is the base.